Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hey America, I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter, and you're about to experience the wild game domain from the hunt to the hearth, airing live on Heritage Radio Network. Today's a big day for us. We have a very special guest in studio with us, Stephen Ranella. Stephen is an avid outdoorsman, a writer, television host, really a jack of all trades. I consider him, for me at least, a spokesman for the industry, for the sport of hunting, conservation, sustainability. He's the author of numerous books. His latest work is Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. I just, not to put myself down, I got the audio version, and I was listening to it in the car. Awesome.
Did you like the guy that read it?
Yeah, that was great. The best part, because my friend thought it was, he goes, we were in the car together. We were checking out a new lease upstate, and I threw it in, and he didn't get it at first. He was like, "What? Did you do this? What's going on? What's with this guy?" And I said,
"No, I don't know, man. They hired an actor for it to bum me out, you know."
And it was very dramatic. I liked it.
Yeah.
I thought it was good, but
I would have put a different flair on it.
Really? Like what?
The next time I do a book, I'm reading it.
Wow, it's a lot.
I'm gonna
of work.
Like insist. I know. Yeah, I don't know. I guess you just, you know, drink some coffee and sit down. I don't know how long it takes to read a book.
Well, see, this is the difference. This is why you're successful. This is why you're the host of a show on the Sportsman's Channel. You're big shot, if I could say. And I'm not. Because you're going to read your own book. I would have been like, that guy's fine.
No, man. The next one I'm going to read.
Well, listen, sure. Let me finish.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please. You're the star here. Steven, should I call you Steven?
Steve? Yeah.
All right. Steve Ranella. He's written in many publications, Outside, Field and Stream, The New Yorker, Glamour, New York Times. You know, for me, he crosses all boundaries. What else can I say here? I'm going to cut this down. I wrote about an hour worth. Best American Travel Writing and Best Food Writing. In 2010, Ranella hosted The Wild Within on the Travel Channel. Currently, he's the host of Meat Eater on Sportsman's Channel. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this
is great because not often you do an interview while actually looking into a restaurant.
All right, so I already said, I admit to all my listeners, I'm an amateur. Guaranteed someone's going to sit right here and eat pizza at 11 o'clock in the morning and just stare at us as we're in here talking. That's how it always happens.
This is great, man. It's like entertainment.
Yeah, cool. So I got a few questions for Steven, obviously, and I'm going to try to take this to the next level. But let's start at the beginning. You grew up in Michigan.
That's right.
And you grew up hunting, or how'd you get into hunting?
My dad was a real avid hunter. I argue in my book Meat Eater, I talk about how hunting is something of patrilineal descent. Like, you know, basically guys, I mean, many, many, many exceptions to this rule, and my apologies to those people who, you know, conform to the exceptions, but typically in the world and throughout human history, hunting has been patrilineal descent, meaning dudes hunt because their dad hunted. That's definitely the case of me. My father, though, his father didn't hunt. My father was raised by his grandparents, who were Italian immigrants. You know, he didn't know the first thing about hunting, but he just found his way into it. You know, he felt he was always called to it. And he was born in Chicago. And when he fought in World War II, he had me when he was pretty old. So he fought World War II. And when he got back from World War II, he got way into big game hunting. And particularly, he was bow hunting, you know, back in the 50s when no one bow hunted.
Right.
You know, This is before they had separate seasons. Guys with guns hated guys with bows.
Right.
So it's like the same thing now. Now you get the whole bow crossbow.
Right.
Like dudes with bows hate dudes with crossbows. Dudes with guns really used to hate guys with bows. So I was just brought up around bow hunting, and we hunted and fished all the time when I was a kid.
So your dad got back from the war. You may not notice, but did you see it as a form of therapy for him? You know, a lot of these guys came back from the war. They needed to kind of get out on their own, get out in the woods. Could that have been his drive to get?
He would never have put anything that way.
Right.
But
because he was a man.
Yeah. And I didn't, you know, and he died. If I could sit down and talk to him now, I would ask him a ton of questions like this. And I don't know if I'd get great answers to it. But I do remember he would tell an interesting story where when he got back from the war, they would still, you know, this was before sporting goods. And he always argued that like places, you know, like Cabela's or Gander Mountain, all this kind of stuff, you didn't really have around. And he thought that the best outdoor clothing out there was just to wear your fatigues, like your military fatigues. And he used to tell this story about that him and his buddies, other guys who served, were all out hunting one day in their fatigues, and they're just going across a cut field pushing rabbits. And he said some guy shot at a rabbit and everybody hit the deck.
Right.
You know, and he says it's still fresh in his head. Also, he always talked about the fact that he went through the whole war without getting a scratch. He got a bullet shot through his poncho one time.
Wow.
He got a Purple Heart for freezing his feet off. But shortly after the war, he was hunting, and his nephew discharged a 12-gauge shotgun into my dad's foot. So he carried those pellets around, and I always thought there was a little bit of irony in the fact that like he
made it through
Europe, and then came home and got shot by his nephew.
Okay, I don't know if we want to promote hunting accidents right now, but I get it. That, see, that's when men were men. I always talk about that.
They used to just shoot each other in the foot,
right?
Just as a way of saying hi.
Moved on, right, with the rabbit hunt. Well, you know, I didn't know that we were going to get that kind of answer. Your father serving in the military and everything. But my next question is, so, you know, obviously you're an avid hunter. We don't have to talk about that. You've hunted all over the world, many different kinds of game. For me, I'm ex-military. I think that, you know, my father instilled discipline in me, but I think having served in the military just, you know, enforced that discipline that I use out in the woods. Where does your discipline come from? Because, you know, many non-hunters, and maybe even unfortunately some hunters, don't realize the level of discipline necessary to take down wild game.
Yeah, I don't really know where it came from, and I think it developed over time. Oh, your prediction was exactly right.
Yep, see?
Yeah.
I told you.
People
clockwork.
Eating pizza.
Right.
36 inches
the
away.
Funny part is they definitely don't know who I am, and they probably don't know who you are, and they just like to sit here and look at us.
So, discipline. I don't really know. I have a theory about it, and I think in some ways it comes from, for me personally, it comes from having two older brothers that I always hunted and fished with. And so it's easy. When you're out in the woods and you're uncomfortable, and this is, I think, where discipline comes in. Like, you're out in the woods, you're uncomfortable, you might as well go home, but you don't. I think that when you're hunting alone, it's much easier to quit and go home than it is when you're with people. So being brought up with older brothers who were, you know, they were tough and they knew how to get it done, I would be with them and I would just be kind of like, didn't want to be the guy that quit.
Right.
So I feel in some ways that came about. Also, my dad was, you know, my dad was kind of a hard person. And I know now that like people that grew up around us would say the same things about our dad. That he was like, they're like, wow, man, your dad was a difficult guy. I never said anything at the time, but you know, I couldn't believe the things he would do to you kids, and not in a bad way, do to us, but just like make us do tasks that sometimes seem mundane, or make us stick through projects around the yard and elsewhere that just were grueling and seemed kind of pointless. Right. And you just learn how to see a task through and get it done. And I take a lot of that to hunting, where when I go out in the woods, you know, I'm there to get what I'm after, and I try not to let anything get in my way.
Right. Now, do you see a lot of your father in yourself now that you have a son?
You know, it's so hard to say. You know, I don't know. I really don't know. I grapple with aspects. I grapple with the legacy of my father, my father's impact. I mean, I grapple with it every day.
Right.
We're way, way different guys because, like, my dad would have never been sitting here having a conversation like this. So in that way, I feel like I'm so different than him. You know, I work in media and do stuff. I'm so different. But I do see little aspects of him pop up. But then he was a guy that spent, you know, a couple years fighting in the biggest war of all time.
Yeah.
I went to graduate school.
Right.
You know, so it's hard to sniff out, like, what parts of him exist in me and what parts don't. And like I said, I would pay so much money now to be able to sit down and, like, now I'm in my late 30s, to sit down and converse with him about some of this stuff.
Well, you know, I barely know you, and I don't know your father at all, but having, you know, just heard your answer about discipline, it was very militaristic in your answer. You know, that idea that, you know, the military uses peer pressure. The first time I jumped out of an airplane, I didn't want to do it. And this is going to come across as sexist, so go ahead and get your emails ready. But I did it because a girl did it next to me. You know,
oh, yeah.
And there's no way I was going to let a girl go out that door in front of me and not do it. And maybe that comes from my father raising me
in the same way.
No,
I understand what you're saying.
You know, so you had the same thing kind of with your brothers. You weren't going to be the quitter. Your brothers were out there. You were going to hang with them. And that's how the military operates, basically.
You know, that's a pretty fair explanation of where you're coming from. And it's kind of open. And I urge you, if you do get that email, to not even reply to it.
No, I'm going to reply. I like it. I'm so sorry if I offended you, but that's, you know, just the way I am. Okay, so now I don't want to get all mushy here. We're out hunting. We're talking about all this discipline, manly stuff. And if anybody has ever watched your show, I mean, you work hard on these hunts. You're out there. This is a fair chase. You know, you're hunting. But at the moment of harvest, the feeling, the emotions that come out of you, you know, what does your insight tell you once that animal is down or you've located that animal that you've taken down? You know, what are some of the emotions you experience at that point?
It really depends on the animal. I should say it kind of depends on the species. Like, some things I've hunted a lot and I don't feel, I don't really have an emotional response to, say, killing a white-tailed deer. I mean, there are far, far more white-tailed deer on this continent now than at the time of European contact. Turkeys the same way. I mean, at the time of European contact, there were turkeys in 39 states. By 1900, you had turkeys in about 29 states or 18 states or something like that. Now you have turkey hunting seasons in 49 of 50 states.
Right.
So I feel like turkeys, white-tailed deer are sort of human creations, you know, like we've made them. We've made them what they are. And I don't really have an emotional response to killing one. That seems more aligned with this idea of like harvesting, you know, like harvesting something you've gone and produced. Other things, like bears, I always have a feeling of sadness hunting bears. You know, like one of my heroes is Daniel Boone. And I remember Daniel Boone killed, 1 year he killed 108 black bears and sold them all. Brined them and smoked them and sold them as bear bacon. And you know, I haven't come near that number, but when I kill a bear, I feel like there is this feeling of like this weird kind of feeling of misplaced guilt and an extended sense of gratitude there. A lot of guys I hunt with, it seems that even guys that really like hunting bears, a lot of guys will just one day stop hunting bears. Like my brother Danny now is just done with it. He don't hunt bears anymore. I mean, that kid is the dull sheep huntingest and moose huntingest, you know, son of a bitch you ever met, but he will not hunt bears.
Right.
So I feel like it's just something that happens to a person at a point in time. I remember I drew a buffalo tag. My book, American Buffalo, is based largely on when I won a lottery permit to hunt for buffalo in the Wrangell Mountains in Alaska. And, you know, it's a less than 2% chance that you would draw the tag. They give out 24 of them that year in 2005. Of those 24 permit holders, only four of us got a buffalo. It's an 8-month season. It's just very hard, very grueling thing to do. It takes a lot of dedication to go get one. And I felt an overwhelming sadness then because it had been something I thought about and lived about for so long and wanted to do so badly. And also because of the very conflicted, complex relationship that exists between humans and buffalo. You know, we were talking about like European contact. The best estimate, we had maybe 32 million buffalo at the time of European contact.
Right.
At a time we got it down, knocked down to like 75 animals in the U.S. Now we have 500,000, largely in part of human efforts. But to kill one, even though I would argue, if we had more time, I would explain this. I would argue that hunting buffalo is the reason we have buffalo today at all. Still, that act of killing one was a complex thing. Not so complex that I didn't want to do it, and I didn't eat it and use it and still have its hide laying out on my living room floor,
right.
But it was a complicated thing for me.
So it sounds like you're kind of justifying some of your hunts in your head almost, you know, if you're conflicted about shooting a bear because of what Daniel Boone did in some ways, or at least if it sounds like you could appreciate the plight of these animals or where they were back then.
Oh, absolutely, man. When I hunt, everything I hunt for, I want to understand the ecological position of the animal or the natural history of the animal.
Thank you.
And oftentimes, you get to, I mean, there's things I absolutely would not hunt for. But one of the great things about the U.S. is we have you know, state-managed fish and game, and it's managed on a state level, and states are under a mandate to manage game animals in perpetuity. Like, that's not their job to run them into the ground. So in the U.S., you can pretty much – it's a safe assumption that if you're following the laws in the U.S., you're behaving in a way that's good for wildlife.
Right.
Wildlife would be in a much, much worse condition in this country if it wasn't for modern-day hunting. I mean, hunters, through excise taxes and license sales, basically fund enforcement in wildlife biology. We fund land acquisition. For all the noise that animal rights people make, all the noise that PETA makes, they don't contribute a dime to wildlife habitat, and they don't contribute a dime to wildlife research. So hunting is really a complex act. On one level, you're killing something, and on another level, you're helping to save habitat and helping to manage animals. If you're not open to that, I think you can go ahead and hunt, but the more you get involved in it, the more you develop an appreciation for animals, you definitely open your eyes to the seeming paradox of being able to say, I love animals and I love to hunt them. If I was gonna say like one sentence or one question that has defined my career, like as a writer and doing television, is how can that be? How can you on one hand say you love wildlife and on the other hand be an avid hunter of wildlife? And I guess everything I've written so far in some way has been my effort to explain that.
Thank you. I've done 16 episodes, and that's the point I'm trying to make, and you managed to do it in 2 minutes.
Just one episode. While watching guys order pizza.
That's the point, exactly. All right, we're going to take a short break here. Before we take that break, I want to mention that we are doing a membership drive here at heritageradio.org. I guess you go onto the website, and we have a couple of different membership qualifications. Student member. Obviously, you know what the show. If you're listening, you know what we're about here at the station. So please try to support us. And we're going to be right back on heritageradionetwork.org with Stephen Ranella.
Music that you're listening to is Top Gun by Tom Cruise, and this is HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Wild Game Domain. My special guest today, Stephen Ranella of Meat Eater TV. So, Stephen, I want to hear your thoughts on the food chain, meaning, are we part of it? Are we in the food chain? Is it okay to participate in that food chain using a firearm? And along with that, I want to hear your thoughts on wild meat, wild game, venison in general. And does your family eat it? Do they eat anything outside of that? I'm sure you have a stocked freezer with all these hunts you're on. You know, I just read a book, The Mindful Carnivore. I don't know if you ever read it. It's a great book. It's Tovar Sorelli. He's going to be a guest in a couple of weeks. And he basically explains the food chain. He's a vegan Buddhist turned hunter.
Uh-oh.
So yeah, so it's a really interesting book. And he kind of outlines the whole food chain and where we fall into it. I was wondering if you had any feelings on that.
I don't even think it's like, I don't even know if it's a fair argument. I'm open to arguments that disagree with my perspective. I kind of welcome hearing them. I just can't imagine an argument, a cohesive argument that would be that we're somehow not, you know, tangled into the predator prey spectrum that seems to have ruled the world since time beginning. a thing people ask me oftentimes is because I advocate a hunting lifestyle, or, you know, I sing the virtues of the hunting lifestyle, and I advocate eating wild game. People often come to me and ask, they're like, oh, so you're saying that all people, in order for them to enjoy their food, should go out and kill a deer? And I would say absolutely not, for a number of reasons. One, we don't have the kind of wildlife we need, that we would need to support everyone being a hunter. I mean, it's kind of laughable. If all 300 and some odd million Americans all went out and killed a deer this year, we would have a deficit of deer in the hundreds of millions.
Right.
As many as we have today, we don't have deer like that. So it's not really even a fair question. I don't think it's something that is going to come about anytime soon. Right now, 95% of Americans or more, you know, don't hunt, choose not to hunt. Another thing I would say is this, is that we have, like we humans have created this thing, civilization, and one of the benefits of civilization is that it enables you to not participate in things you choose not to participate in. We don't process our own raw sewage. Most of us don't build our own homes. You know what I mean? There's all kinds of things that we've decided to not do and let someone else do so that we can focus on the things that bring meaning to our lives and that we're impassioned about. So for me, I've chosen to, and I like to go out and secure my own meat. It's just something that I've chosen to do, and it has great meaning to me. If other people decide that they want to eat meat and choose to contract out their obligations, I don't think there's any more of a problem than there is to send your raw sewage to somewhere else for processing. It just doesn't bother me. What was the second aspect of the question?
So the meat you harvest, your family, do you buy meat at the supermarket? You know, what's your feelings on?
I don't buy meat at the supermarket, but I will eat meat when I go out in restaurants. You know, I travel a fair bit. I'm in and out of restaurants. I like restaurants because I like knowing. I like to kind of follow what people are doing with food. I enjoy eating out in restaurants. I try in restaurants. I try to order in a way that is responsible according to my understanding of wildlife and fish and game, or not game, but fish populations particularly. I try to be mindful when I'm eating in restaurants. But in home, I eat wild game. In home, my wife eats wild game. Every night that I'm home that I cook, that's what we're eating. Last night, we had pasta with doll sheep merguez, so like a doll sheep sausage that I made. And so it might be that the main showcase of our meal is very protein-based. We might just sit down and eat some salad greens and a big roast. We might sit down and eat pasta and pasta sauce that I obviously purchased elsewhere, combined with, you know, a couple sausages that I made myself. So I don't eat a strictly carnivorous diet, but I eat a very meat-based wild game diet, you know?
Right. That's great. So, you know, responsibility, you know, when you're talking here, I'm thinking responsibility, even in buying meat, you know, at a restaurant, I don't care where you're researching it. You're part of the scene. You're not going to Stop and Shop and buying pork chops off the rack.
Yeah, I try not to, man. I mean, I try to do a good job. But the thing is, as you know, in life, like so many things are complicated that you might come away with one feeling. Like now there's a lot of talk about, you know, GMOs. So people are down on GMOs. You can look at it one perspective. All GMOs are horrible. On the other hand, if you talk to someone who is tasked with trying to feed the world's poor, they might argue that on the other hand, we have a greater potential to feed the world through genetically modified organisms than otherwise. You might say that everything should be organic, but then you might talk to a food scientist or someone who works for the USDA, and they might offer you up the perspective that if everything was organic, you better plan on losing about 33% of the world's population to starvation, because we're just not going to have the output to match it. So all of these things make it like really complicated. The older I get, like when I was younger, I'd probably been more prone to having all these absolutes, you know? But the older I get, the more I realize that things, when it comes to food, are so nuanced and so complicated. But one thing, that's kind of why I like wild game. One thing that's not complicated about it is in my house, for my family, I cook wild game. I have plenty of it. I have a stocked freezer. I keep enough wild game where I keep a lot of friends in business on wild game. You know, I keep them fed and their families. So it just is a way where I can rule out all of the headache of trying to sort through the morals of it by knowing with moral certitude that the food that's in my freezer was sustained or was procured in a sustainable, as humane as possible fashion. And I wouldn't argue to you that being killed through hunting is the most humane way to die. I've seen enough stuff to know that sometimes it's not entirely humane.
Right. Well, as a bow hunter, I primarily bow hunt. And I've obviously seen that, and by my own mistakes. You know,
yeah, absolutely, man.
And, you know, that's something we all strive to never have happen, but we all know it happens.
Yep.
Just this past season, I took a bad shot, and I couldn't find the deer. And, you know, I searched for days, and we got a dog out on it and everything. And then I was ready to quit bow hunting over it. And, you know, a buddy gave me the advice. I had texted him and told him what happened. And he just said, get over myself. That deer was going to die anyhow. And if you're not bow hunting enough, if you never miss, you know. And I was
that's the thing that I often find, and I think that bow hunters, we're off on a tangent now, but as an archery hunter, I can go and say this. I think that bow hunters really try to hide. They try to hide this sort of like dirty secret about bow hunting.
Right. Well, we don't want the public to know because, we're trying to promote the sport and it's ethical and you know, it's humane to the animal. And
someone might say, oh, I got a bad hit, and everybody's kind of,
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, really? It was a little high.
Conversation kind of moves on, you know. But no, it is an aspect of it. But I think that when you're looking at, you know, wildlife management, I think you have to really look at the overall picture. And it's quite obvious to anyone who looks into it in a serious way that the animals that are managed as game animals in this country thrive and do well and are enjoying expansion of range and expansion of numbers.
Right.
And so within that, you might have individual mistakes that are made, but overall in the U.S., we're doing just a really phenomenal job on wildlife management.
Right. I preach that all the time. You know, wherever we're hunting them and managing these animals, they're flourishing and doing great. You know, the only problem I see is places, you know, being from Long Island, out on Fire Island, I keep going there to see those animals because they're suffering, you know.
I don't understand it.
I saw one the other day, a spike, and last year, and his antler was growing through his bottom jaw. You know, so that's malnutrition at some point. But, okay, we only have a few more minutes here. It goes so quick.
Man.
If you had to pick one pro hunting organization to support, what would it be and why?
I work with an organization called TRCP, Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. What I like about TRCP is they work on behalf of many, many organizations. So what they do is they're kind of almost like a lobbying wing that's in D.C. working on behalf of things such as Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Trout Unlimited, all kinds of great organizations. So it's easy for me to keep up on the conservation debate by looking at the things that TRCP is involved with. With that said, I'm also involved with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. I'm involved with Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, who have an immense amount of respect for. And I guess the groups that I like most are the groups that they might pick an animal as their, you know, like Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has the elk. So they pick the animal as this emblem, this charismatic megafauna, we call it. But what they're really about is habitat conservation. And when you have these big apex species, and you're helping them, you're inadvertently helping everything else, you know?
Right.
To save elk wintering ground, you are saving landscapes that will be used by all wildlife.
Right.
So in that way, sure, you might have this animal that you're parading around and celebrating, but what you're really doing is you're speaking about habitat and habitat preservation.
Awesome.
And loss of habitat is really what's – I think loss of habitat is the greatest threat hunters face today.
Absolutely. Okay, you're settled in Brooklyn now, right? How long have you been in Brooklyn?
I got married in, I can't remember when I got married. 2008? No. I got married in 2008. Yeah, so I've been here since then.
Okay. When are we going to find you in the woods of New York or Long Island when you're coming out?
I was the other day, man. I was hunting. We got up at, me and my buddy got up at 1:30 in the morning and went up and hunted turkeys at another buddy's dairy farm outside of town.
Nice.
But typically I typically hunt out west. Like on Monday I leave for Alaska. I'll be in Alaska for a while. I got a place in Alaska, so I'll be up there at my shack hunting bears and fishing for halibut and stuff. And then I'm here all summer because I'm doing a lot of writing right now. And then August I'll head back up to my place in Alaska and hunt blacktail deer. And I'll fish more, and I'll hunt mountain goats on an island near the island I have a place on.
And then I imagine you get into your filming. That's
then, at that point, we'll be going full balls. And so we'll be filming in Colorado, a lot in Alaska, British Columbia, Kentucky, just, you know, getting all around.
Right. All right. So I debated this. Everyone knows how I feel about the New York Safe Act, but I have Stephen Rinella here. great outdoorsman, great spokesperson for the industry, for hunting in general. The New York Safe Act, gun control in general, any quick feelings on it? I know you don't own an AR, and Stephen, that's okay. I own one.
I'm not, you don't have to. I'm certainly not going to apologize.
That is America.
Yeah, no, I own what I own. I have, you know, the firearms that I choose to use hunting, the things that are that I'm comfortable with and like to use. With that said, I'm very uncomfortable right now with the directions that a lot of states are going on gun control. I feel like the issue is spinning wildly out of control, and I think it's what's driving it is a lack of understanding about firearm, your general typical firearm owners. And I think it's kind of becoming like this societal debate of people who occupy one spectrum of American society against people who occupy another spectrum of it. And it's causing like undue collision. I don't think that the firearms regulations that people are talking about right now are going to mean a thing. They're not going to do anything to curb gun violence. I'm not seeing it. I don't understand how people can look at what's going on with violence in America and think you're going to solve these problems by taking legal gun owners and making their gun rights secondary to something else, or making the purchasing of firearms and ammunition like an onerous process. I feel like all you're going to do, really what's happening right now, is you're driving legitimate businesses out of state. You're pushing legitimate people to make them feel victimized. It kind of makes me sick to see it happening.
All right. Now you believe me. Stephen Rinella said it. All right. Now listen to me, people of Brooklyn. Stephen, I got to thank you for coming in today, man. Great interview. You know, I don't want to get all sappy here. You're one of my idols. Love your show.
Thank you, man.
I think you do so much for the, I keep calling it the industry. I don't know if that's the right word. The sport itself, you know, hunting in general. And you're a great spokesperson for what we do. So thank you.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Guys, before I do my outro, as they call it, Heritage Membership Fundraising Drive, I think we're calling it. It's very important. If you love the station, get involved. Log on to our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and help support us. Become a member. Thank you. That's all the time we have. Heritage Radio Network. Thanks to Stephen Rinella. Great show. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.